Its numbers, therefore, are 3 because it is under the influence of the rings, 7 because it has matter of 7 types, 12 because it has been acted upon by the 12 rays, and each of the 7 planes of matter will have its particular number, from 3 to 9 inclusive. This, having passed out through the placid planes of cosmic matter, and taking with it as much as it can draw from each plane, arrives finally at its own plane, where an equilibrium is established between the centrifugal and centripetal forces of the cosmos and its own bulk. It then settles down upon its orbit. The cosmic influences to which it is exposed can be calculated in an orderly sequence, because they are definitely established. It will pass round the 12 rays, and experience the change of the phases of the rings, and in addition to this, the influences of the great organisms of the other planes will, whenever their orbits happen to bring them near to each other, for they move at different paces upon different planes, influence the matter drawn from that plane in the makeup of that system. This great organism that we are considering has settled down to its orbit, and you can conceive of it as a nucleus of that original traveling atom surrounded by great cloudy, unformed, unorganized belts of matter of the different planes. These are held about by attraction of its mass. The limit and extent of its attraction marks the extent of the system. Like all else in the cosmos, this mass has a rotating movement which is derived from the original central atom. The movement of that atom within its orbit gradually, in the course of untold ages, flattens out into a spinning disk. Then the motions, which you saw in the formation of the cosmos, are gone through, because the laws of motion are the same on every plane, and the solar system sorts out its matter into 7 planes owing to specific gravity. Section 2. Chapter 7. The evolution of a great entity. Conceive now the experience of existence as it is apprehended by the dawning consciousness of a great entity. Hitherto we have looked at the evolution of points of manifestation from without, we will now consider the matter from within, as it appears subjectively to that cosmic unit of manifestation referred to as a great entity. First, conceive the sensation of a whirling, and no other sensation at all. Conceive yourself becoming so habituated to that whirling that its cessation would occasion a sensation but not its continuance. Conceive a secondary motion developing, perceived at first because of its newness, and losing its stimulative power owing to habituation, as did the primary, and so on, in sequence. You will now perceive that movements that are habitual must be maintained if an absence of distracting sensation, which is the basis of attention, is to be arrived at. Therefore the accustomed movements are implicit in the being of that which is based upon them, and when awakening into manifestation it will always seek to establish these motions as the basis of its existence. Now cast your mind back over the teaching given you by your previous teacher, and recall the phases of movement to which the great entities became habituated in the course of cosmic evolution which led to their development. And you will see that all these movements have become implicit in their nature and will be reproduced when they, in turn, set out upon that inner elaboration which constitutes the next phase of cosmic evolution, the phase of the evolution of the great entities, bearing in mind that upon whatever plane or ring of the cosmos the entities settle down for a cycle of evolution, the numerical values of the evolution will be determined thereby. We will now consider the evolution of that great entity with which we are especially concerned. Implicit in its nature are all phases of the cosmos, hence the significance of the hermetic maxim as above, so below. Whatever is developed under a certain set of conditions reproduces those in the recapitulation through which it goes, prior to the undertaking of original development. The great entity then, having this basis of cosmically evolved factors to work upon, combines and recombines them into the infinite diversity of a manifested universe. Therefore the infinite diversity of a manifested universe can be dissolved into the prime simplicity of the cosmic beginnings. Each phase or aspect of the universe has its origin in a similar phase or aspect of the cosmos. A great entity, having settled down upon its cosmic orbit, proceeds upon the work of evolution. Having had the cosmic factors implanted in its nature by the experiences, it proceeds to bring them into function independently of the cosmic impulse of its own momentum, which momentum may be called a cosmic will. You will perceive that we are still speaking in terms of dynamics. It is not until a high degree of evolution has been achieved that we can speak in terms of psychology, but there is an unbroken line of development from movement to thought. Tangential movement is a simple form of reaction. Thought is an infinitely complex form of reaction. It is a question of difference of degree, not difference of kind. Fundamentally, there is no difference of kind in anything, because all can be reduced to the prime central stillness, but upon the planes of manifestation there are differences of kind, because the rays issuing from the central stillness diverge as they proceed, and as consciousness is limited in its objective functioning to one plane at a time, a unity of the innermost cannot be conceived save by the consciousness that stands therein, and, as the transition from one plane to another of any ray or line of force is marked by a subdivision of that ray, you will perceive that there are differences of kind in manifestation, although there is a fundamental unity. Differences of degree are reckoned along the length of the same ray. Differences of kind are reckoned in the sequence of rays round the circle. This digression, which, strictly speaking, belongs to another section of the subject, is made here to ensure clearness of comprehension in the argument pursued. A great entity commences its evolution by developing, not the cosmic rings, but the concept of those rings. That is to say, it puts in motion the memories of the experiences it underwent when that which afterwards condensed into its substance, was part of the primordial swirlings. It knows good and evil, and therefore is a god. It is the knowledge of good and evil which enables it to manifest, because the good is a dynamism, and the evil is a thrust block. The ring pass not of a universe is the limitation of the attention of the great entity forming that universe. It is its determination to concentrate its attention upon the task it has set itself. You get the equivalent in the psychological mechanism of the sensor, and in the processes of the concentration of attention. Chapter 8. The relation of a great entity to the cosmos. A traveling atom, having passed through all the phases of cosmic evolution up to that of which its production is the crown and completion, makes a final journey to the central stillness. Then, by the overbalancing of the equipoise, it issues forth, but with this difference, it has itself become, owing to its development, a center of attraction. Thereby it draws to itself a certain number of atoms of each plane through which it passes until it arrives at the cosmic belt, which is decreed as its habitation by its own specific gravity in relation to the centrifugal forces of the cosmic whirlings. There will be then, in this new organization thus formed, a central nucleus of the traveling atom. This central nucleus will have implicit in it the modes of reaction to which it became habituated during its experience of the phases of cosmic evolution. In order to achieve the absence of sensation to which the presence and the continuance of habituated reactions in their accustomed ordered sequence alone can give rise, this nuclear atom continues to make its accustomed reactions owing to the momentum of its particles. These actions upon its part induce the corresponding reactions of the loose aggregations of matter from each cosmic plane that are gathered about it. Thus is built up a miniature cosmos. As may be perceived by a little thought, this cosmos, with the nuclear atom corresponding to the central stillness, which, in the larger cosmos transmuted all reactions, in this, the reflected cosmos, performs the same function. At the same time, the entire organism is subject to the phases of the cosmic forces. Its synthetic aspect receiving an impulse during the phases of the cosmic day, so-called, or those segments of the circle in which the positive or stimulative forces are predominant, and its analytical forces receiving a stimulus when passing through those segments of the circle in which the negative forces predominate. Likewise, as it passes through the sphere of influence of each ray, will the corresponding forces of its own nature receive an additional stimulus. You may conceive, then, this great organism traveling round a circle which is divided into four quarters, positive and negative alternately, and in addition to this each quarter is subdivided into the spheres of influence of three rays. You have now the key to the so-called days and nights of Brahma, and to the periods of evolution, But, as this great organism we are now considering is itself a miniature cosmos, you will perceive that a more speedy cycle will be performed within its own nature. In addition to these influences, there is another set of influences to be considered. These influences being the gravitational attractions of other great organisms upon other planes of the cosmos. The relations between one great organism and others upon its own plane are fixed and determined before evolution commences, and, being constant, need not be considered. But the revolutions of great entities upon other planes of the cosmos are conducted at different paces and without relation to those entities of other planes than their own. Therefore they will pass in line with each other periodically, momentarily blocking the pull of the central attraction upon those organisms further out than themselves, and also exerting a gravitational attraction upon all particles of their own plane and planes above their own, in the mass of a great organism on an outer path. This cutting off temporarily of the central attraction upsets the equilibrium of the outer organism, removing the centripetal check upon the centrifugal force, but the tendency of certain types of molecules to fly inwards towards the attracting body tends to counterbalance this. Also, the whole will of the nuclear atom of that organism is to maintain constant the habitual conditions which have become the law of its nature. The habituated conditions, it may be said, in parenthesis, are those sequences which man discovers and christens natural laws. Likewise, the forces of the cosmos tend to maintain equilibrium, compensating each other, but there occurs, nevertheless, at irregular intervals, conditions which require compensation, and these give rise to varying degrees of irregularity in the movement of great entities, and hence to the presence of positive evil, sin and disease within their spheres. The cosmos itself has to strive to attain adjustment at the commencement of each phase of its evolution, and the irregularities which occur before adjustment is effected, and which have to be pulled straight in the course of evolution, are the origin of this evil, in the sense in which the word is used popularly. Cosmic evil is all imitation, an opposition, and is the prime condition of manifestation. This cosmic evil, the divine death, is implicit in each great entity, and is the basis of its manifestation and evolution. For without limitation, finiteness, there can be no manifestation, and without death or discarding of the outworn, there can be no progress. These elements then of cosmic opposition are always present in a manifested universe, but universal evil, under its two aspects of sin or perverted force, and disease or perverted form, are due to the irregularities of orbit caused by passings of great organisms upon different planes of the cosmos. These are always found in their extreme form at the beginnings of an evolution, and are generally adjusted in the course of an evolution as compensations are made, until, at the end of an evolution, a perfect and rhythmical balance of the whole cosmos has been achieved, a synthesis of action and reaction which maintains stability. You may conceive of the cosmos as extended in space and in time. But when you come to consider a great entity, its parts or aspects are not extended in space or time, but are implicit in its nature as habitual reactions which are made whenever and wherever the appropriate stimulus is forthcoming. Therefore, all the phases of cosmic evolution, the rings, the rays and the planes, occupy neither time nor space in the organism of a great entity, but are implicit in its nature. This is the fourth dimension, the dimension of the implicit nature of the nuclear atom, which determines the nature of the manifested universe which it projects. We have seen then, that the traveling atom builds itself a form of cosmic substance out of the matter of the seven cosmic planes, and this form, of which the nuclear atom with its habituated reactions is the ensouling life, is subject to the influences enumerated. We have now, you will perceive, traced two phases of evolution, the cosmos phases, and the more rapid recapitulation of the phases of the development of a great entity, and we have studied that great entity in its relation to the cosmos which is its environment, and to the central stillness which is the compensation of all forces of the cosmos, which is its God. We will now consider the life of a great entity in relation to the universe of which it is itself the God, the creator, the conditioner and the sustainer. you will perceive that a great entity comes out from the central stillness and takes its place upon its appointed circuit, and conducts its organization under the influence of the negative or destructive phase of the cosmos. And this may seem strange to you, that creation should take place under the influence of a destructive phase of the cosmos, or any other organization which, by overbalancing the synthesis of forces achieved in a phase of evolution, causes them to embark upon a fresh phase of development in order to re-establish their harmony, and as they commence this phase with the experience of the preceding phase implicit in their nature, they commence where the last phase ended. They climb upon its shoulders, and thereby evolution arises to a greater complexity, for it has now become an organization of organisms. You will see this principle prevailing throughout all things, great and little, above and below. It is one of the cosmic principles, and one little known, if known at all. Likewise, the phases of development during which a great entity organizes itself are internal and therefore subjective. They are not carried out under the stimulus of sensations derived from external conditions, but under the stimulus of feelings arising from internal conditions, and the phase corresponding to the phase of existence which a human soul passes through between death and birth. This phase, having been completed, a great entity, having arrived at the greatest degree of organization which it is capable of with the conditions at its disposal, can go no further. Being organized throughout, each part is affected by, and responds to, changes in any other part. It is therefore fully conscious, for consciousness is but awareness, and awareness is but reaction to a stimulus. The conditions of its nature, being habitual in their sequence, no longer give rise to conscious stimuli. The great entity has therefore a consciousness, but nothing of which it can be conscious except itself. The cosmos, be it noted, being entirely habitual to this entity, forms the conditioning background of its consciousness, which is comparable to the human subconsciousness of the automatic level. It has then created, by the sensations of its own nature, a concept of itself, of which it is aware. Here then, is a novel sensation, and it dwells upon it. This is the self-consciousness of a great entity. This is a creation. And God made man in his own image and likeness. A universe is a concept in the mind of a great entity. It is created by the self-contemplation of a great entity. The consciousness of a great entity then, being aware of this image of itself as a whole, next becomes aware of the changes in the proportions of the forces of its own nature caused by the influences through which it passes, thus giving rise to fresh concepts concerning itself, and these concepts are added to the existing complex, conditioning it historically. These are the different outflowings of creative force concerning which you have heard. This teaching concerning the subjective and the objective aspects of a great entity is the key to the doctrine of pantheism, which is a half-truth, as generally understood. For a great organism holds in its memory the cosmic conditions, although it itself does not contain the cosmos of which it is a part. Likewise, the mental picture of itself projected by a great entity reflects that great entity in its entirety, being the product of perfected consciousness. But it is not that entity of which it is the emanation, though it is entirely conditioned by the nature and experiences of that entity, having no other origin and being exposed to no other influences whatsoever, for it has no other existence save in the consciousness of the entity conceiving it. Therefore it is not affected by cosmic conditions, being of another order of creation to the great entities which are the fellows of its creator, and all of which, in course of time, projects their concepts of themselves. It is, however, affected by the cosmic phases because the great entity, which is the basis of its existence, is affected by them. It is this fact that secures a universe from disturbance and permits of no intervening influence intruding in the relations between it and its creator and sustainer, its God. Its God, therefore, is omnipotent as far as it is concerned, though himself conditioned by the conditions of the cosmos. Its God is infinite as far as it is concerned, because he is all that is to it. What he is not, as far as it is concerned. But he himself is finite in relation to the cosmos, which is infinite as far as he is concerned, being all that is for him, though itself finite in relation to the unmanifest. Omnipotence means free from the influences of any conditioning power. Infinite means the sum total of the influences towards which an organism is capable of reacting. A universe, then, is a thought form projected by the mind of God, the relation of the God of a universe to the cosmos, to the universe. He is evolved, he is its creator and conditioned and sustainer. By it. Finite. Infinite and omnipotent. Chapter 9. The projection of the concept of the universe. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. Gen. I. 2. As we have already seen, a great entity projects its concept of itself. This, however, is not the beginning of objectivization in a universe, though dealt with first in the order of instruction in order to make that which follows more comprehensible. For the great entity, when it projects the image of itself, found substance of the same nature as the projection, awaiting the organization which that projection should bring about. It will be recalled that the great entity gathered about itself atoms of each cosmic plane, out of which it formed its body. These atoms themselves are entities, though of a lesser degree of development than the great entity of which they form a part. Being of lesser development, the full recapitulatory growth is achieved earlier. Each atom, having realized itself, has created a concept of itself. These concepts, projected by the atoms, are not atoms, but so many units of knowledge of ways in which reaction is possible. They are not, therefore, sorted out into concentric belts, because there is nothing in them upon which gravitation can act. They are merely forms of reaction. Now the consciousness of a great entity is not aware of the individual reactions of its atoms, any more than the consciousness of the cells composing its body. Therefore, when it seeks to conceive an image of itself, it has to take the reactions of the different types of atoms in their respective aggregates, and is dependent upon the atomic concepts for the creation of the necessary atomic images. Therefore, the great entity has to create its concept of itself in objective substance, and is therefore limited and bound by conditions of the nature of the already created images which it utilizes. Thus the atoms, by conceiving their own images, perform the primal act of creation. The first act of creation proceeds from the body of God, and is but a mass of unorganized units. Darkness was upon the face of the deep. These units having no organization, and consequently no relations among themselves, could not attain to objective consciousness, but as soon as the concept of the great entity, based upon its cosmic experiences, became projected, it organized them into relationships, and they then became conscious of each other, became affected by each other. It will thus be seen that the cosmic atoms created the atoms of each prime subplane of manifestation, and that the atoms thus created, by being brought into relationship each with its own kind by action of the great entity, developed into subplanes. The prime atom of each plane then, has a direct relationship with its corresponding plane of cosmic substance, and consequently is influenced by the great entities upon that plane. Hence there is always a certain opposition to the great entity of a universe on the part of the atoms which form its matter. This is very important point. We have seen then first the projection of the atomic concepts, then later, the projection of the great entity's concept of itself, which organizes those atoms into a miniature cosmos which is called a universe in these papers, to distinguish it from that stage of existence which gave rise to its parent and creator. Chapter 10. The relation between the projected image and the logoidal consciousness. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, Let there be light, and there was light. You have heard in previous lectures how the atoms, or units of manifestation of a universe, are formed, and also how the currents and tides of divine power are set flowing through them, so that an exact replica of the cosmos is formed in miniature, the correspondences being exact, save that the cycles of a universe, moving in a smaller radius, have a more rapid rhythm. Note that a rhythm is but a series of repetitions. Two phases of logoidal evolution have been outlined: : the phase of the development of the matters of an universe; b) the phase of the development of the tides and rays. The one is the raw material out of which a universe is made. The other is the skeleton, the framework upon which it is built. We have then enormous quantities of atoms differentiated only into planes, and subplanes of planes. Seven distinct types and seven subtypes of each type. We will now consider the third phase of logoidal evolution. At the beginning of an evolution, the logos is alone in that sphere which is afterwards to become its universe. It is conscious only of itself, for there is no object in existence within that sphere of which it can be conscious. It will thus be seen that the logos reverses the order of the psychologist's concept of the evolution of consciousness, having first cosmic consciousness, then self-consciousness, and then objective consciousness. The logos then is now aware that a thought form has been projected from its consciousness into its aura. For, under one aspect, the universe may be conceived of as the aura of God. This consciousness of an object produces a reaction in the logoidal consciousness. There is a subject-object adaptation, and this adaptation produces a corresponding modification in the reflected universe which becomes capable of an object-subject reaction. Thus a relationship, or reciprocity, is established between the logos, or great entity, and that projected image of the logoidal consciousness which is the incipient universe. It must not be thought, however, that the logoidal consciousness is limited to awareness of its objectified universe. The logoidal focused consciousness, or conscious consciousness, is thus limited. For a focused, or conscious consciousness, can only be built up out of awareness of, and reactions to, objects. But the logoidal subconsciousness is aware of the cosmos, and the consciousness is influenced by the subconsciousness which is its basis and background, and as the cosmic tides ebb, flow, and move round the circle, the corresponding aspects of the logoidal subconsciousness are stimulated by their influences, and the sensations thus engendered in the logoidal consciousness are forthwith incorporated in the self-projection, which is the universe. And the conscious consciousness of the logos perceives them there, so that an infinite series of reactions, and modifications of reactions, proceeds. At first in broad and simple movements, but gradually multiplying into an inconceivable complexity. All these modifications influence the atomic matters of the incipient universe, and determine their nature and characterize them. It is these characterizations that are subsequently discovered by man as natural laws, or observed sequences. Thus are the natures of things determined. They are built into them by the logoidal reactions to the conditions of its cosmic environment, and these modifications are constantly proceeding. They do not endure for a phase and cease, but continue as long as the atomic subplanes to which they correspond are in existence. Thus an elemental evolution proceeds apart from the evolution of life and form as we know it. Chapter 11. Auto-reactions and cosmic memory. You have perceived in the course of these lectures that each phase of evolution, whether cosmic or logoidal, starts with a new type of action or reaction, and every possible variation is worked out by adding the possibility of reaction to the reactions already established. It resembles the possible number of changes that can be rung upon a chime of bells, and the addition of a bell to a chime makes possible a great increase in the number of variations which can be performed. Thus each new factor evolved increases the complexity of manifestation, and when the utmost diversity, of which the factor renders the universe capable, has been arrived at, that phase of evolution has reached its maximum development. And there is a pause in the process while the logoidal consciousness perceives what has taken place, and sees that it is good, and by absorbing it into its consciousness effects a new reaction, which reaction is, in its turn, projected into the manifested universe, so that evolution resembles a series of duplicating mirrors wherein the consciousness of the logos projects its own image, becomes aware of, and reacts to, the image thus projected, and the reaction affects the projection, and so the circle is everlastingly revolving. You will perceive that the logos, or subject, has become aware of an object, that object being a reflected projection, or replica, of the subject. Awareness of an external object on the part of the subject must be reproduced as a corresponding reflection of consciousness in the object, so that the object is equally capable of awareness of an external object. But the object, being of a different order of manifestation to the subject, cannot be aware of the subject but can only be aware of itself, and of the influences which proceed to it from the subject. Hence the saying that no man hath at any time seen God. God cannot be seen by any unit of the manifested universe during a manifestation. He can only be deduced.